As a church, we've just finished a series on the 9 core practices that comprise the Bridgetown Rule of Life. And as we continue to integrate it into the shared life of our church, we wanted to provide a resource to help explore what a rule of life actually is and how we came about integrating one into our context at Bridgetown Church. So we've created a 4-part podcast that will expound on these 2 questions, providing a helpful account of where we've been and how we hope that a shared rule of life will direct where we are headed. As we often say around here, we believe the future of the church is ancient. If we desire to move forward in our identity and calling as a unified community, we need to do so having the robust foundation of a rich life with God built out of shared practice. We believe these conversations will be a helpful resource to you as you consider what a rule of life looks like in your context, and we hope you will join us for this journey as we seek to be made into God's image together. Hey everyone, this is the 2nd in a series of 4 conversations that Tyler and I are hosting about rules of life. Our hope is that these conversations will help our church family at Bridgetown have better understanding of what a rule of life is as we kind of seek to integrate the Bridgetown rule of life into our congregation. So today, I'm really excited. We're having a very, very special conversation with Dr. Jerry Sitzer, who is an expert and scholar in church history. And actually, I was just telling him, has written one of my all-time favorite books on church history, Water from a Deep Well. And I remember exactly where I was when I read it. I was on an airplane and I openly wept as I read through this book because it was so beautiful. It really...
Did you read the entirety of it on
Oh, no, flight? No. It was
okay.
I was gonna say,
it's a pretty long book.
It was a long flight, but the first half of it I got through on this trip because I was just so engrossed in it and just wept on the flight. It really changed me. And I was telling him, not just at a theological level, but as a pastoral level, I think it really shaped the way that I pastor people. So high recommendation to that to anybody who's interested. But with that, let's go ahead and dive in. Jerry, thanks for being with us today. We are very excited for our conversation.
Thank you. My pleasure.
Let's start with talking about, you're a church historian. Where does the idea of a rule of life come from? How has it maybe been preserved throughout church history? And I think the honest question a lot of us are asking is, if it's actually an ancient practice or as big as we seem to be saying that it was, why have 95% of us never actually even heard of it?
Well, the phrase rule or rule of life it probably dates to early monasticism, but I think you could make a pretty good case that it's biblical. Read the Sermon on the Mount, for example. That's a really good example of a kind of rule of life. You notice the categories that Jesus develops, the Beatitudes. You've heard that it was said, but I say to you, and he addresses issues of worry and anxiety and so on, judgment. So I would look at the Sermon on the Mount as one example. I'd look at Romans 12 as another example. I mean, it reads like a rule. There's kind of mission statement in the first 2 verses, and then it talks about our giftedness, that we're responsible to steward our gifts, and then it turns our life into the mutuality commands in the body of Christ, how we're to honor each other and so on and so forth, and how we're to treat our enemies. So those would be 2 examples of rules of life that I think, even though we don't use the word, they show evidence of having a similarity to that. When it comes to the early Christian period, again, predating monasticism, we know quite a bit about the early Christian catechumenate that emerged sometime in the 2nd century. We don't exactly know when or how, but there are hints of it all over the Roman world, where churches developed a long on-ramp for converts to move into the Christian fold. I mean, there are 2 obvious reasons. One is that many of them were converts from the pagan world, and they knew nothing. They didn't know the Christian story. They didn't know anything about Christian practices. They didn't have categories, theological categories that most of us take for granted, like creation, fall, redemption. They were a blank slate. Actually, they weren't a blank slate. They had a lot of bad ideas and practices that they had to overcome. And so the church developed a 2 to 3 year process to move them slowly into the Christian fold. And that would culminate with what they called the rites of initiation, baptism, confirmation, and their first Eucharist. When you look at this catechumenate, it involved mentoring. They called it a sponsor. It involved clear teaching, that is, the story of Christianity, basic doctrinal beliefs. They actually called those rules of faith, not a rule of life, but a rule of faith. You see these popping up all over the Roman Empire, long before there were creeds. And finally, a rule of life, how they lived. And they introduced these seekers or these converts, but pre-baptized, to a way of life, not after they learned the Christian faith, but while they were learning the Christian faith. That's a very different model. It's not as if they were saying, here's how you believe, and now you can decide whether you're going to live it. They introduced it as a complete package, that belief and behavior and belonging were part of a larger seamless whole. It's telling because when you look at the questions, they called that the scrutiny that the bishop issued to converts just before their baptism, the bishop or the elder didn't just say, do you believe in God the Father Almighty? Do you believe in Jesus? Do you believe in the Holy Spirit? He would ask that candidate, the catechumen, he or she was called, do you visit widows? Do you take care of the poor? Do you visit prisoners? And this was part of their baptismal scrutiny. Now, we've lost.
It was about belief and practice.
It was about belief and practice, and they were simultaneous, and both were necessary to become church members. Well, the turning point in terms of the culture of the church was in 313. This is when Constantine gave, I'm going to call it, he legally recognized Christianity as a legitimate religion in the empire, even though the empire was still pluralistic. In the year 381, basically 60 years later, 70 years later, the Emperor Theodosius made it the legally established religion of the empire. So what happened is it received recognition, and then it became established. It became culturally fashionable, and the church began to invest in the success of Christianity. Scholars compute that or estimate that in the year 300, just before the last great persecution of Christianity under the Emperor Diocletian, the empire may be constituted or comprised 10% Christian. By 360, over 50%.
Wow.
Well, that tidal wave of people into the life of the church, now they're going to church buildings, and they're huge buildings. We actually have some of them still standing. They were called basilicas, and they could seat 2,000 people.
Wow.
And people started to attend church to cut business deals and to find nice Christian girls to marry and so on and so forth. And the catechumenate began very slowly to suffer neglect. And it became, over the next few hundred years, pretty much culturally, not just culturally acceptable, but culturally required that you be Christian. It began with infant baptism and then would go all the way to extreme unction and rites of passage when you were ready to die. So Christianity became...
And you said that happened over how many years?
Oh, it was several hundred years. It didn't happen at all. And the catechumenate didn't fade overnight. For the next 150 years, it was still the practice of the church. We have catechetical sermons that come from church fathers in the late 4th century, for example. But gradually, it began to fade. And the catechumenate and the rule of life was passed into the monastery. Now, let me just jump into that for a minute. The second century was the most stable century of the Roman Empire. Once you get to the later third century, just before Constantine, Rome starts to experience a tremendous amount of stress. Agriculture is suffering. Tribal groups are beginning to push from the north, south, sometimes leading to warfare, sometimes leading to mass migrations. in the year 410, the jewel of the empire, the city of Rome that had between 1 million and 1.5 million people, was actually sacked by a tribal group. That would be like ISIS or, I don't know, the Taliban sacking Washington, D.C. I mean, it's just by the year 426, the last emperor was deposed from the throne, and another emperor did not sit on that throne in Rome till the year 800. So it was just a bad, very stressful period in the empire. I read an editorial in the New York Times in 2021, and the editorialist was asking, will 2020 go down as the worst year in world history? Well, I knew that was nonsense, but I got me curious. So I just Googled, is there a worst year in world history? And I discovered that there's a kind of humorous consensus that there really was a worst year in world history. Mm-hmm. So I'm holding up to that right now, and there's a reason for it. So in the year 5, we have all this stress happening in the Rome.
I love this teaser. Okay.
This is great.
So Rome, in the year 300, as I said, Rome had between 1 million and 1.5 million people. Mm-hmm. By the year 500, it had less than 50,000.
Wow.
Think about that.
Wow.
It's catastrophic.
Yeah.
And all cities declined all over the Roman world. Constantinople was still doing fine, but that's the eastern part of the empire. So all this was going on, and the army was extended, a lot of unnatural deaths and imperial succession. I could go on about this. But in the year 536, there was a series of volcanic explosions in Iceland. Now, of course, they didn't know that. They didn't know anybody was living in Iceland. And they were so catastrophic, it literally created around the world a year of darkness. There was so much ash poured into the atmosphere. In the same year, there was a massive comet that hit Australia, sending another mass of particles into the atmosphere. It snowed in Italy in August. Cultures from around the world mentioned this particular year. It set off massive famine, weakening the population, setting them up in the year 540, just 4 years later, for this explosion of Justinian's plague, probably smallpox. Scholars estimate that another 10 million people might have died from that plague.
Wow.
Okay, so I feel that for the listener, I need to attempt to summarize where we've been. Because we started with, where does rule of life come from and why haven't I heard of it? And then we got to summer snows in Italy.
All right, so, there's a reason.
I know, but just here's where we've been. Yeah. In early church history, would you say as early as the second century or is even the first century, there is precedent for rule of life under the banner of catechumenate in the early church community?
In the Didache, which was written around the year 100, three pages are devoted to what the author calls the two ways.
The way of the Didache would be the earliest church document that we have record of, other than the pages of the New Testament itself.
That seemed to outline a rule of life. This was called the two ways, the way of life and the way of death. And then it's all over.
So it can't get more ancient than that.
It can't.
But then a rule of life gets essentially sequestered into only the monastic expression in this period of plague that you're describing now.
Okay, so first we have an explosion of growth. Mm-hmm. And a Christianity that becomes more culturally fashionable. And at the same time, we have Rome suffering enormous stress and decline. All right, so I asked the question, what Christian leader was alive in the year 536? And I had an aha moment.
Saint Benedict.
That's exactly right. So Benedict comes from an aristocratic background, grows up outside Rome, goes to Rome to complete his education for public service and maybe even service in the church. He's disillusioned by what he sees in the city that is just suffering such deterioration, withdraws into a cave and practices the ascetic disciplines that came from the desert, desert fathers and mothers.
Mm-hmm.
He attracts a group of disciples, tries to put them to a rule. They rebel. They try to poison him. He escapes with his life, goes south of Rome.
It's quite a rebellion. I mean, yeah. I've preached some bad sermons. It's never gone that bad for me.
Yeah, right. I still have somebody else taste the wine when it's brought to you. Just
okay. Okay.
Anyway, he withdraws south of Rome, again, begins to practice the ascetic disciplines, grows as a holy man, attracts disciples. And then he decides, I need to make this clear. And what results from it is the rule of Saint Benedict. He died in 547, so he was living right during this period. Now get this, Gavin and Tyler, when he died, he left behind 12 monasteries of 12 monks each.
Wow.
But it was, they lived according to a strict rule, sort of on the margins, but they ended up serving the mainstream. They started in the desert and they worked themselves slowly back into the city. And they became the service providers pretty much in anything you'd want for the next 500 to 600 years as this movement began to grow and spread.
Wow.
I mean,
when you say the service providers, like, give me an example of what you're describing.
Education, especially remedial education, libraries. They copied manuscripts. They stored them. They produced scholarship. They were the inns. Benedict's rule says you can turn no one away who knocks at your door.
Yeah, treat every guest as Christ.
Okay, there you go.
Yeah.
Experimentation in animal husbandry and agriculture, settling of land, the clinics of the Middle Ages, the missionaries of the Middle Ages. Monks went to all of those tribal groups and all of them were eventually evangelized, however superficially. By the year, say, 1100 or 1200, you could not travel a day in any direction living in what we now call modern Europe without running into a monastery. They were ubiquitous.
Wow.
You don't have an institution in the modern world that was as formidable and influential and dominant as the medieval monastery.
Wow. And there are Benedictine monasteries all over the world and all over the states still today.
Still used, they still use it as a working document. Now, there were other rules. Basil of Caesarea wrote a rule that's still used in the Eastern Church. Mm-hmm. Augustine wrote a rule for a community of nuns that is still used around the world today. And that ascetic and monastic literature still has wide circulation, but in a very narrow swath of the population. The larger church has lost the memory of this. But they carried over the early Christian catechumenate, which carried over the kind of life to which Jesus and people like the Apostle Paul called us to live. Now, Benedict,
yeah, I think what I'm hearing you say is there was this wildfire period in early church history where the church is spreading like crazy. Yeah. Church is on fire. The way of Jesus is taking off. And a rule of life is living within the local church community during that time.
Correct.
Then there is this moment where essentially the empire gets into the church more than the church gets into the empire, and the way of Jesus becomes diluted. And the potency of the church is renewed by a number of folks, but Saint Benedict being maybe the one who most popularized the renewal. But the renewal wasn't a new innovation. It was simply a return to the ancient way, gathering in community, living the way of Jesus, as we see in the Didache and the Desert Fathers and Mothers from the early centuries. And that essentially takes us through 1,100 years of church history.
I would say yes. I mean, eventually, Benedict produced bishops for the church, leaders in the church, and scholars. And around the year 1100, cities start to grow again, and culture becomes more stable. And then they give rise to universities and hospitals and the scientific enterprise and a growing literature and artistic. So that movement becomes diffused in the life of the church, and we call that Christendom. Christendom is not a dirty word to me. It's just a phase of the history of the church where Christianity was the dominant worldview. It led to tremendous cultural achievement. It led to a terrible abuse of power. For our purposes, probably the biggest problem was the two-tiered system of spirituality. If you would go anywhere in Europe in the year 1200 and ask 1,000 people, are you Christian? 999 would have said yes. Mm-hmm. All 999 might not have known what that meant.
Sure.
Access Christianity largely through the sacramental system. Mm. Not just the sacraments proper, but buildings and festivals and other practices like the rosary, for example. Then there was a more select group of people who practiced in a more vigorous kind of way, and those were the monks and the nuns. Mm-hmm. It's interesting that in the Middle Ages,
there was essentially a Christian subculture
correct. In
the ancient world.
Yeah. And mm-hmm. there was a bridge between the two, and those were local priests, but many of them were uneducated and even had part-time jobs as farmers or whatever, and they were called seculars. The spirituals were the monks and nuns, the seculars were the priests, and then the lay people were kind of lowest on the totem pole, and the least was expected of them. Mm-hmm. But we have a renewal.
Mm-hmm. And okay.
Yeah, and that's, if I can, that maybe goes into a great second question, which is, in my kind of studies of rules of life throughout church history, the one thing that, or not maybe the one of the things I've noticed to be unique about the Bridgetown rule of life, when compared to, I guess, mostly some of these monastic rules of life, is that we're not requiring a vow of celibacy to participate. As you think through our rule of life, the idea of a local church congregation having a rule of life for all levels of folks involved, from our elders on down to our kids' classrooms. What is that? Is there precedent? Are there counterpoints in church history where rules of life were not just for, I don't know, monks and nuns, but also for normal people who are living in a city, working jobs, having families?
I'm going to give you three examples that are all relevant in different ways. Hmm. So the monastery and the lay people were pretty separate by the year 1200, 1100. Monasteries were usually in rural areas. They would develop huge tracts of land. They became, in many ways, very large and prosperous and powerful. There were some Cistercian monasteries that would have 800 to 1,000 monks in them, and they would live according to a rule of life. Meanwhile, more and more people were moving to the city. They were getting a university education. They were functioning not as producers, but as managers and bankers and contract writers and lawyers. So rather than producing something, they were managing those things. Hmm. And they were hungry for a new experience of spiritual life. Two geniuses emerged at the same time. They never met each other. They didn't collaborate together. And they began to bring the spirit of the monastery back into the city. So not only did they call people to meditate on the life of Christ, they began to use the language of imitation of Christ. There you go, mm-hmm. following the way of Jesus. Mm-hmm. And the two names will be familiar, at least one for sure, is Francis of Assisi mm-hmm. and Dominic. They eventually, the originators of two religious orders, the Dominicans were more preachers and intellectuals, the Franciscans also preachers, but they tended to pursue the life of poverty and so on. Well, they were dazzling in their impact. The Franciscan order grew exponentially. It was magical. That order didn't grow as fast, but it was actually more stable and organized. Well, the lay people were so hungry for this experience that they wanted something, but many of them were working secular jobs. They were already married. They had families. So these two religious orders created what were called third order or tertiary movements. And these were for lay people. So you could become a kind of third order Franciscan or Dominican and still live a kind of ordinary life. It had a monastic tilt to it. So they tended to practice the ascetic disciplines and so on, but they wanted to live out those values in the city and an ordinary life.
When you say you've used the term ascetic disciplines a few times, and I know what you are referring to, but I think maybe the average listener may or may not know what you mean. So could you just define aesthetic disciplines for us?
Aesthetic disciplines tend to focus on the deprivation of the appetites for the sake of the cultivation of the spiritual life. So fasting
that
would
was
be
a stunning definition.
Incredible. Hold on.
So fasting, for instance.
Fasting, a solitude, silence, celibacy, those kinds of things. Deprivation was always essential to it, but it was meant to cultivate a deeper and richer spiritual life. And the appetites were the enemies that would get in the way.
It's the restraining of an appetite for the inflaming of a deeper one, yes.
That would be a great way of putting it. Yeah, you should actually be the one being interviewed here. You're really good at this, Tyler, seriously. Anyway,
I'm literally just trying to play translator for people whose brains are the size of mine and not yours. Let's continue.
Well, I'll give you an example of the monastic tilt, one of the fashions that emerged with greater force beginning in the 13th century was what they called celibate marriage. So at times you would literally say your vows at the marriage altar and then at the same time commit to living a celibate life. An alternative is that you would do your duty and have children and then commit yourself to celibacy after your years of childbearing were done. I don't want to say it was widely practiced, but it was clearly an alternative. That's why I call it, it had a monastic tilt to it. There was a women's movement started called the Beguines in the same century. 100 years later, a student movement called Brethren of the Common Life. So these, you can see this sprouting of new experiments in the spiritual life for lay people. It was not church-based, but neither was it monastery-based. It was more based in homes or in little communities of people who would live together according to a rule of life. Okay, so that's one example. The reference
and Saint Francis and Saint Dominic, just so that we're tracking
correct
historically, is that 14th century?
Oh, Francis died in 1226.
Okay,
Dominic around the same time. Their orders were both approved by Pope Innocent III, I believe it was in 1215 or around there. So early 13th century, and these third order movements or student movements flourished over the next couple hundred years.
Wow! So I remember reading Water from a Deep Well, the book that Dr. Jerry Sitzer has written that Gavin was referencing before, and being fascinated by these sections, in particular the Beguines, that women's movement. I just remember never having heard of them, being so fascinated. And so you can read more in a very accessible format there. But I'm curious about this. So we're doing something that we're drawing a counterpart to by reaching back to the 12th century. And we've seen there's this steady stream within the church for the first 1200 years. So what happened in the last 1,000 years, and why would this be so common that you have these different tertiary movements popping up at the same time during that period, and so uncommon that it feels like we're doing something crazy when in fact we're doing something that is quite ancient to the way of Jesus?
Well, there are other movements that have come forth. We don't call them, they didn't necessarily write a rule of life. The Reformation is a good example. The Reformation did a couple of things that were really important in the life of the church. They developed handbooks. The weakness of the handbook, they were called catechisms, is that they were more doctrine-oriented. All catechisms, and there were many, many dozens of those produced, all were Q&A in format. And the learning tended to be more rote, more doctrine and memorization, less practice. So that was one of the main documents that the Reformation produced in the 16th century. The sermon also dominated in the 16th century as a form of communication. I'll get this, Tyler. John Calvin averaged preaching 290 sermons a year for 15 years.
Wow.
And those
that's sermons, 45 that's minutes. That's a lot of sermon prep.
That's a lot of sermon prep, yeah. So it was very doctrine, teaching, information driven.
Would that be because of is that the Enlightenment?
No, that predates the Enlightenment by 250 years, but it is the printing press. And, and a growing lay people who are hungry for more education and instruction, and the failure in many ways of the Catholic Church to keep pace with that.
Okay.
The other two things that are important in the Reformation is their emphasis on vocation. You can live out your life with Jesus, not through a church vocation, but through a secular vocation. You can be a baker or a banker or a doctor or a scholar or a farmer and be just as faithful to Jesus as you can be in a church vocation. A huge contribution in the history of Christianity. The other one is that they valued marriage and family as an arena for discipleship. Every one of the reformers, to my knowledge, except maybe one, I think Melanchthon, I'm not sure, all of them married. They chose self-consciously to marry, and some of them had been priests or monks. Luther was, and he married a nun. This was a theological statement that marriage comes under the rule of God. It's a legitimate form of Christian discipleship. Luther wanted his catechism to be taught in the home. It didn't work very well. So pastors began to take it over and teach it on a Sunday afternoon. I think that's a great loss. I would have rather had Luther train fathers or mothers, mostly fathers back then, of course, to do that kind of work. And so the Reformation tilted toward doctrine as the Third Order movements tilted toward monastic values. Now, third illustration. One of the great early Lutheran leaders was a man named Jacob Spener. He was a scholar and a pastor.
I've heard you talk. You love Jacob Spener.
Well, because I love this. He's so big in terms of his transition. He looked at the church and said, we've got all these people who know Lutheran doctrine and are living appalling lives. And so he wrote a kind of manifesto called My Pious Desires. And it was a massive critique of the church, and then a kind of manifesto of what the church can do to cultivate conversion and genuine discipleship. Now, he remained a lifelong Lutheran. He didn't think Lutheran doctrine was the problem. It's that they didn't work it into practice. A jump ahead about 50 years, and John and Charles Wesley emerged. They're Anglicans. They were schooled in the Book of Common Prayer, but they both had conversion experiences in their 30s, and they introduced all kinds of new things in the life of the church: open-air preaching, a call for conversion, modern hymnody, and a class system of disciple-making. And John Wesley attributed the substance of the movement and its success to the early Christian catechumenate. He mentioned it. He said, all we're trying to do is follow ancient practice. The tragedy in my mind with the Wesleyan movement is that it broke ties with the Church of England. Part of it was their impatience. Part of it was the mean-spiritedness of Anglican leaders, at least some, that just did not welcome the Wesleys at all. They would persecute them. And so we had a split between more established state religion, Anglicanism, and the Wesleyan movement. By the year, 1820 or 1830, the Methodist movement became its own movement and developed its own subculture of what we now call evangelicalism. But the class system was meant to be a disciple-making way of producing leaders for the church and multiplying churches. And it was very successful. There were some 4,000 Methodists in America in the year 1787 when they had their first kind of conference. This is when it wasn't even an independent movement yet. By 1850, it had over 1 million people.
Wow.
It grew fast. Yes, but its root system wasn't deep enough. And that is the weakness of evangelicalism in general, is that it has a shallow root system. And that's why I think I feel so strongly that dipping into the ancient church, certain medieval practices, the great hymnody, the great writing, the great art and literature of the church is going to drive that root system deeper and make us more stable Christians.
Hmm. Amen.
Yeah. Yeah, amen to that. And on that, you've talked a little bit about this. I'm wondering maybe we can conclude with a question of, you know, you've studied the last few, the last many centuries of church history for the last few decades. I'm wondering what makes you excited about a local church trying to live by a rule of life? And maybe on the other side of that coin, what cautions would you offer churches or individuals who are trying to adapt rules of life for themselves?
And can I share one thing on that too, Gavin?
Yeah, yeah.
Jerry's going to answer. I think it would be helpful for the average attender of Bridgetown to know that we've shared some of the story of John Mark and I kind of batting this around together and conversation with different conversation partners, you being one, Gavin, Gemma, who we've talked to on another podcast episode being one, and Dr. Sitzer is one who really has encouraged and been excited toward John Mark and I in conversation about cultivating such a rule of life for a local church, and said, you guys should do this, and kind of like really breathed on it and gave confidence that we're not just playing fast and loose with church history or, fooling around with ancient practices that we don't know enough about or something, but has said, yes, this is an important thing for the church and you should go for it. So yeah, great. I would love to know where that excitement comes from. And then, of course, like Gavin said, some cautions as well.
Well, the first thing to note is that in many of the renewal movements in the history of Christianity, they've not been firmly situated in local churches or parishes. Hmm. They've often been, I don't want to say marginal to the church, but not rooted in the local church. Hmm. The Third Order movements weren't, although I'm sure people went to Mass, back then. The Reformation movement did, but notice that the Catechism turned it in a more doctrinal direction. It wasn't necessarily a disciple-making movement, even though we can be indebted to some of the great things that it did. The Wesleyans just created their own denomination in the 18th century. And it's ironic that within, 80 years of the birth of the movement, they're starting to build church buildings. They're looking a lot like other churches. So they kind of bled into what was more culturally fashionable at the time. Evangelical Christians have started a lot of voluntary associations, a lot of student movements, but they're only indirectly connected to the life of the church. Now, I will say two things. One is that a lot of these movements have emerged during a period of crisis. And when that occurs and the church is facing tremendous stress and stress, maybe even decline, it sets off a lot of experimentation. People go back to the Bible. People ask different questions. They look for new models. They experiment. They often fail. But then every once in a while, you hit on a success and you're off and running. All right? That has happened a number of times in the history of Christianity. We have one other thing working to our advantage as local churches now, is that right now in America, most social institutions are declining and declining precipitously. Robert Putnam started writing about this when he wrote Bowling Alone, and his last book called Upswing is a massive social scientific kind of encyclopedia just plotting how much stress and decline we're suffering in America right now, including in the church. But I will say, in spite of how much stress and suffering we're facing as a church, we don't have much competition right now. So the field is wide open. I know we face challenges and lots of problems, and that's why I think this could be a great hour for the local church, is that a lot of voluntary associations or parachurch organizations are suffering and declining. We don't have the buzz about Young Life or Youth for Christ or Navigators or Crew that we had in the 70s and 80s. I mean, they're still functioning, doing good work. I'm not pronouncing a death sentence on them, but they're certainly struggling in a lot of ways, as many secular social institutions are. We're not sending our kids to Boy Scouts anymore. And if we are sending our kids to something, it's to niche organizations like an AAU basketball club or a volleyball club.
So this is fascinating. I've not thought about this.
We have a wide open field if we can play it right and begin to create these little communities of belonging, of faith, of healing, of discipline through a rule of life, but always have them grace-filled.
Wow.
I love what Benedict says. He, in chapter 4 of his book, he lists 72 principles of discipleship, and they are not for the faint of heart. He says, think about hell all the time. Remember that you could die today. Never lift your eyes in pride on another person. I mean, it's really severe. Mm-hmm. And here's the last principle, the last one, never despair of the mercy of God.
Mm-hmm.
I love that.
Yeah.
Benedict, I want to kiss him. I want to say, Benedict, thank you. You called us back to grace.
Wow.
So I think the opportunity is manifold right now. My concerns are a couple.
Yeah, I was going to say, it feels like there's a natural transition to caution there.
Caution one is we don't want to create a two-tiered spirituality again. Those that are the real Christians in the church and those that are not the real Christians, that's very easy to do. Somehow we need to cultivate a culture of discipleship that does not create that two-tiered system, but helps people understand it's a process. Some people start far back. They've been alcoholics. They've been divorced three times. They've come out of a drug culture. They've got their own story to live out. Other people have grown up in lovely Christian homes and have had lots of nurture and investment from godly people. From God's point of view, it doesn't matter. We all have our own stories to live out, and they need to be filled with grace and have a trajectory that's pointing toward the way of Jesus. So one size does not fit all. Beware of.
Would you say that the key to avoiding creating that two-tiered system would be that those living by a rule of life, or maybe, you know, whatever outwardly might appear to be a more rigorous form of discipleship, are functioning more like fathers and mothers, lovingly inviting a congregation, helping to raise up maturity rather than elder brothers in the prodigal son sense?
That's a perfect analogy, actually. We don't want to have elder brothers. We want to have fathers who are pacing on the porch, waiting for their young son to come home, but then goes out to the elder son and says, all that is mine is yours. You've always been with me. We had two prodigal sons, not one. We had the inside of prodigal son and with the outside of prodigal son. They were both prodigals. The religious person can be just as much the prodigal as the wayward son can be. It's the father pacing on that porch, longing for those sons to come home. That's why in any rule of life, we should always turn it toward the betterment of the church, not away from it. Instead of standing in judgment, we're looking for people to love and invest in and encourage. We're listening.
So for those living by a rule of life, you should watch carefully what this is doing to your heart.
Yeah,
toward your brothers and sisters in your local church.
And what it's doing to other people. How are they being affected by it? Do they feel like they're being pushed out? Are they feeling like the lepers? Or are they feeling like the woman at the well after Jesus met her?
Wow.
Great questions. Okay, next caution.
We need to drive the root system deeper, especially even in the evangelical world. We're cursed with shallowness. What we do really well. We're incredibly creative. We call people to conversion. We love the Bible. But it's easy for us to forget that we are sitting atop 2,000 years of wealth. And a few more hymns, a few more great texts, a few more works of art, anything that helps us remember that we belong to something much bigger than we are. And those people were not stupid or lost, even Catholics. In fact, I preached at a Bible church a couple of weeks ago, and the pastor is trying to move them really slowly toward a richer liturgy. And so he led them in a confession of sin, which is not standard practice. Mm-hmm. And it was from the Book of Common Prayer. Mm-hmm. And so I said to the congregation, you've just been borrowing from the Anglicans. Mm-hmm. And Thomas Cranmer, the author of that book, borrowed from the medieval Catholics. Mm-hmm. Smart Christians are scavengers.
Mm-hmm. Hmm. Wow.
And we draw from those resources. Now, we don't have to read thousands of books to do it, just a few. Mm-hmm. Instead of memorizing 100 hymns, 5. Reading a few short texts instead of ridiculously long ones. Mm-hmm. But storing up, growing, driving that root system deeper, because a deeper root system means more fruit.
Amen.
We desperately need to do that right now. We're really bleeding. We're prisoners to our own thinness.
Mm. Mm.
And that doesn't mean we have to be apologetic for our own past and our own tradition. We just need to add to it.
Mm. Yes.
It's beautiful. Wow.
Thank you.
Yeah.
This, that was so enlivening. Even your cautions were enlivening.
Yeah. I'm over here taking all kinds of notes. I can't wait to even listen back to this. So, man, Jerry, thank you so much for, I feel I said this in a podcast before, but thank you for your faithfulness. Thank you for the life that you've lived dedicated to Jesus and to the Bride of Christ, and the way that that's producing a level of fruit in your life that we get to, the image in my mind is like of a big giant tree, and we get to kind of sit under the shade of the life that you've lived and enjoy the fruit that your life is producing.
Oh, thank you.
Thank
the
you.
Image of a tree, I think, is really useful for us when we think about pushing forward here. We want to grow strong, stately, beautiful trees.
Hmm.
Psalm 1 mentions that, and I think it's a lovely image we don't use very often, and I'm quite attracted to that image.
Hmm. I love that. Well, thank you for being a tree. Thank you for modeling to us.
We're trees too. We're all trees. We're all groves in this together, you know, and
yeah.
We want to be a forest of different sizes and shapes and textures and species, but as an ecosystem, be unbelievably healthy and flourishing.
Mm. Yeah.
Yeah. I can feel that Gavin is signing us off. So I just want to say in closing, many who listen to this, this will be the, you know, the majority or the first of their exposure to you, Jerry. And so I want to commend, Jerry has authored a number of amazing books. We've referenced on this call, Water from a Deep Well, which, I mean, you just heard this man in 45 minutes, basically take us through the AD period of human history, particularly as it relates to the church, but also as it relates to weather patterns and plagues.
Yeah.
and that is a primer on church history. If you're looking to draw to deepen your root system, that is the place that you could begin. And then also Jerry's book, A Grace Disguised.
Yeah.
Tells his story of following Jesus in the hand that he's been dealt. And I would just say it is a beautiful invitation to understand what fidelity to Jesus looks like over the long haul. Mm-hmm. And there's not a lot of people who can talk about church history like that, have lived the way of Jesus like this, and it's just an absolute joy to be at a dinner table with. And Jerry Sitzer is all of those things.
As long as it's good.
So thank you for joining us.
I should say one other thing, and that would be maybe Resilient Faith introduces you to a kind of a primer to that early Christian period.
Yes.
Oh, great. Yes.
Resilient Faith.
Thank you for saying that. Yeah. Wow. Oh, man. Thank you so much for your time. Thank you for everything that you brought to our conversation today. I think our church is better because of it. So thank you, Jerry.
I'm honored. Thank you. You're wonderful human beings. It's just lovely to be with you.
So nice. Thank you.
Our hope is that as you've listened to our conversation, the Spirit was stirring a desire in you for some piece or part of what we've talked about. If that's you, we'd invite you to engage the Rule of Life through one of three invitations. First, consider taking a deeper dive into one of the practices by going through our Practicing the Way courses. Next, consider exploring and integrating various practices by joining a Bridgetown community. And lastly, if you have already cultivated most of the practices into your life, consider becoming a part of our Covenant community, a group of people committed to the long, slow, formational journey of paying attention to how the Spirit uses these practices to form us. You can find more information on any of these invitations at bridgetown.church/ruleoflife.